Geekscape.com.
White Supremacy and Negro Subordination, Part 23. The Alliance of Northern and Southern Producers. In the foregoing chapter, it has been shown how slavery, or the presence of the Negro element in our midst, has given origin to the American idea of democracy, to more expanded and truthful conceptions of our true relations to each other, to mental habits which led Mr. Jefferson to promulgate the grand idea of equality in 1776, to make that great movement a revolution of ideas as well as a war of independence, to render the latter a mere preliminary for ushering in a new political system based on the equal rights of citizenship and the starting point of a new civilization, widely and radically different in its fundamental idea from anything ever before known in the political experience of mankind. It has been shown that Hamilton and Jefferson, the respective leaders and exponents of the opposing ideas and tendencies of the time, merely reflected the mental habits that belonged to the different social conditions then existing, or of the different constituencies which they represented, and after the great contest for independence, which they passed through harmoniously, was closed, and a new system of government was to be created, that the ideas of Jefferson generally prevailed, and the present government embodying those ideas was established. It has been shown, moreover, that both of these great men, and those who acted with them, were equally honest and equally patriotic, that neither nor any of them could rise above the level of opinion in their respective sections, for then they would no longer have been representative men or able to influence the people. That the opinions of Hamilton reflected the mental habits of the North, which clung to the forms and spirit of the British system, founded on artificial distinctions, while Jefferson, reflecting with equal fidelity the mental habits that originate in a different social condition, where a subordinate race is in juxtaposition, advocated a democratic system resting on the fixed and indestructible laws of nature. And in view of all these historical facts, and inductive facts, the conclusion was deemed irresistible that the presence of the Negro element in our midst, the existence of a natural substratum in the social elements, which thus secured the liberty of our own race, the legal and political equality of white men, was the happiest event or conjunction of circumstance that has ever happened in the history of mankind. But while the great Northern leaders thus consented to the establishment of a democratic system, they were driven on by their own tendencies, as well as the mental habits of their people, to neutralize its forces and to pervert its spirit. At that period, suffrage was extremely limited, while the agricultural class in the northern states, compared with the present, may be said to have been extremely ignorant. The Northern, or Federal Party, were thus enabled to get possession of the new government and to give it such direction as their opinions and interests doubtless seemed to demand. The president himself, the illustrious Washington, was without decided political convictions. His instincts and his family traditions, it is believed, inclined him in the direction of the Northern Party, while the local tendencies of opinion, the general mental habits of the Virginians to regard the distinctions of race as the legitimate basis of political order, generally restrained him, and in the mighty conflict of opinion kept him in a neutral position. He formed his cabinet out of wholly incongruous materials, made Jefferson Secretary of State and Hamilton Secretary of the Treasury, and selecting other exponents of the conflicting opinions, sought to neutralize the contending forces by an equal selection of subordinates from the hostile camps. The public credit, the restoration of commercial confidence, was the first and most pressing want of the country, as well as of the new government, and in this Hamilton found a pretext for adopting the British system of finance, which he foresaw would enable his party to recover, to a great extent, the ground lost in the creation of the government, and in practice, whatever might be the theory entertained, restore it, or closely approximate it, to his darling model, that favourite British system, which he and his associates believed to be an embodiment of political wisdom. The idea of the British aristocracy, and that government is an instrument designed for their benefit, was deeply implanted in the northern mind, and is so still. In England, it is a practice which the idea has simply originated in. Official employments, pensions, and special legislation or monopolies in England embrace all, or nearly all, the ruling class, and therefore, the idea that government is established for their benefit necessarily follows. This idea of government is generally embraced by the northern mind, even in our own times, and the habit of looking to this vast and beneficent power as the source of pecuniary benefits to the people, if not to a class, is almost universal among the northern people. Hamilton, brought up under the British system, was deeply imbued with it, and placed in power, it was natural enough that he and his associates should construe the Constitution in a way to give it effect. The state debts that were contracted for carrying on the war were assumed by the new government and formed a basis for a national bank, which was soon established, and the rapid restoration of public credit that followed the restoration of public order and a settled society in a young and vigorous country was claimed by the federal writers as a proof of the wisdom of their policy and the extraordinary ability of their leader. Mr. Jefferson opposed this policy from the beginning in all its aspects: the adoption of the British system of finance, the assumption of state debts, the creation of a national bank, in short, the entire programme of federal policy. He held with the state rights, democracy of our day, that the central government was a factitious and limited government whose powers were derived not from the collective people, but from the people of the several or united states, that the Constitution should be literally construed and the practice under it strictly confined to the plainly enumerated objects, and therefore that the creation of a national bank, assumption of state debts, and the rest were unconstitutional in principle and dangerous in practice. Hamilton and his party, on the contrary, held that the financial policy they adopted was not only the wisest that was possible under the circumstances, but that the consequences likely to follow, the consolidation of power and prestige of the central government, would be of the greatest possible value to the people. Indeed, the old contest between Massachusetts and Virginia, the conflict of ideas, the warfare of widely different mental habits which preceded and ushered in the government, were renewed and accompanied by a bitterness of spirit quite unknown in the former case. Hamilton, impelled by the opinions of the North, assumed in practice, if not in theory always, that the central government sprung from the collective or the American people instead of the people of the states, and was almost unlimited in its powers, and he doubtless believed that the more extended its powers, the safer and more stable would become the country, and the more prosperous the people. He had failed to obtain such a government as he especially desired, a government after the English model, republican in form, but aristocratic in fact, a government based on those artificial distinctions which the mental habits of the North were accustomed to regard as the only safe foundation, and now in power, with the prestige of the great name of Washington to support his policy, he doubtless believed himself a patriot, and as performing vital service to his country and to posterity, when he thus construed the Constitution and consolidated the powers of the federal system. Indeed, the fear of the people, of a reckless and disorderly multitude, was the abiding sentiment of the great northern leaders, and the consolidation, power, and grandeur of a central government that should restrain them was the object of all their efforts. Thus, the very objects the Federalists aimed at, doubtless from patriotic motives, for there being no laws of primogeniture, there was no permanent class to be benefited by their policy, were the very things that Mr. Jefferson and his friends contemplated as the greatest danger to the country. Hamilton desired to construe the Constitution in a way to build up an enormous central power that should hold in check the tendencies to disruption and disorder, while Jefferson believed that the greater the assumption and the consolidation of power in the federal system, the greater the danger to the freedom of the states and to the people. Or, in other words, the Federalists believed that the more the central power was enlarged, the greater the scope and strength of the federal government, the more certain were the states to be kept from disunion and the restless multitudes from anarchy, while Jefferson and his party believed that this assumption of power in the central government would result in the overthrow of the government itself if there was no other way of obtaining redress and of preserving on the part of the states and the people of the states the liberties which they fought for in 1776. Such was the great civil contest that sprung up under the administration of Washington, but which was constantly restrained by the presence of that great man, who, without any very decided leanings as regarded the parties to it, was, moreover, eminently practical and earnestly disposed to favour conciliation and peace, rather than commit himself to the abstract opinions of either side. It was only, therefore, during the succeeding administration of Adams, that this fundamental conflict of ideas, this conflict which involved the very foundations of government itself, and which, back of the immediate actors that figured in the scene, originated in the different mental habits that spring of necessity from different social conditions, reached its culmination and prepared the way for that final solution which the great civil revolution of 1800 afterwards accomplished. The Federalists, or more properly the Centralists, had construed the Constitution in a way to make the government in practice substantially what they believed it should have been in theory. They had adopted the British system of finance, had created a national debt, and a national bank, which, as in England, was to be the agency for the deposit and disbursement of the public revenue, and from the necessities of the case, a vast and overshadowing monopoly which was to hold the credit of the states and of every individual in the states at its mercy. In fact, the states were rapidly sinking into mere dependencies and subject provinces of the vast and overshadowing power of the central government, which, not content with its usurpations over the states, tending in practice to almost obliterate the lines of state sovereignty, even sought to strike down the liberty of the individual citizen, and in its alien and sedition laws to exercise absolute powers. Those laws authorized the president to imprison and punish citizens and others as his fears or caprices might dictate, with few, if any, greater safeguards for the citizen than in absolute governments of the old world. The Federal Party embodied the British idea of government, and their notions of liberty differed little, if any, from those of the mother country. Liberty in England consists in the equal protection of person and property in an ordinary sense, but as liberty, in fact, consists in an equal citizenship or an equal voice in the creation of laws that all are called on to obey. Of course, those who have no vote or voice in these laws are to that extent slaves. It was the policy of the Federalists to limit this great natural right of suffrage, and in all the states where they were in the ascendancy, they sought to do so, as indeed was legitimate and consistent with their fundamental idea of government. Equally consistent and legitimate was their habit of expecting pecuniary benefits from government, for this, as has been said, was the practice in England, and the idea or theory that sprung from it was deeply engraved upon the northern mind. While the Federalists, therefore, sought to consolidate power in the hands of the federal government and to weaken the states, all the selfish and mercenary interests of the day were naturally attracted to a party whose public policy thus favoured and invited their cooperation. The conflict of labour and capital, the frightful antagonism between those whose labour produces all wealth and those who own the wealth produced by past generations of labourers, is at the bottom of all the revolutions and civil commotions of modern times, for it involves the whole subject of government, as well as all those mighty social evils which so disfigure and deform European society. In England, this conflict has, in one sense, reached its utmost limit, while in another respect, it may be said to be at least active or less palpable than anywhere else. The few who own the wealth, produced by past generations, are the wealthiest in the world, while the many who produce all the wealth of the present are undoubtedly the poorest. Those who produce everything enjoy nothing, while those who produce nothing enjoy everything. A political economist of great eminence has made an estimate of the present wealth of England and declared that, if equally divided, every man, woman, and child in England would have £10,000 or $50,000, and yet supposes that there are 10 million people who never own a dollar beyond their daily support. The land is owned by some 35,000 proprietors, many of whom have large parks containing many thousand acres filled with game and left untilled, while millions of men and women of their own race, their own kind, are without a single foot of that which God designed for the common sustenance and comfort of all. Education, moral development, and happiness must go hand in hand with those things, of course. Indeed, it is a truth that should always be recognized when estimating the well-being of masses of men, that their moral and physical well-being are necessarily inseparable. No one, however ignorant or prejudiced in favor of Britishism, or British liberty, can suppose for a moment that such stupendous results as these, or that such a social condition as that of England, could ever be brought about by natural causes. They are all of the same race, with the same natural capacities, as well as wants, and if there be any difference, or any natural inferiority, it is within the governing class, whose intermarriage among the landed aristocracy has deteriorated their blood and reduced them below the normal standard. It is the government, therefore, the contrivance or political machine, which has worked out these tremendous results, that has dug this mighty chasm between beings whom the Almighty has created alike, and therefore forbidden any governmental distinction. The notion that government should benefit their condition therefore, should make them richer and happier, originates in the fact itself in England, and those who, like the Federalists, formed all their ideas of government after the British model, sought naturally enough to wield it for those supposed beneficent purposes. There was the same social conflict, in a degree, at the North as in England. It was the interest of the capitalist or employer to get all the labour possible with as little expense as might be, while the labourer would naturally seek to get as high a wage as possible, and in return give as little labour as possible. The capitalists, the men of wealth, the professional classes, merchants, indeed all classes of northern society, except the agricultural class, were attracted to the federal party, and in addition, speculators and projectors of every kind were naturally drawn in the same direction. These classes, embracing all the wealth and cultivation and social influence of the day, rallied in support of the federal party, which, with the government in its hands, with the prestige of power, and nearly all of the intellectual men of the time on its side, was irresistible as far as the North were concerned. The producing classes, the farmers and labourers, those only that were naturally opposed to its policy, or whose real interests were in conflict with its policy, were then comparatively helpless. The right of suffrage was exceedingly limited, and though the agricultural class largely outnumbered the others, they were ignorant, without guides, and indeed quite helpless in the grasp of the federal leaders. The federal party, as has been stated, had, by so construing the constitution, usurped power that rendered the government substantially such as they originally desired to establish, and the masses, without intelligent leaders, were powerless to resist. And anyone intelligently contemplating the condition of things in the northern states during the administration of the elder Adams must be irresistibly forced to the conclusion that the masses, the labouring and producing classes, were wholly unable to relieve themselves from the oppressions of this party, short of a physical revolution and an appeal to arms. They were largely in the majority, but the right of suffrage, being mainly confined to property holders, labourers, mechanics and artisans, were, as in England, disenfranchised, while the agricultural classes, though greatly advanced, no doubt, beyond the same classes in the Old World, were yet extremely illiterate and ignorant, and therefore powerless. The policy of the Federalists was absolutely the same as in England. That is, the government was a machine or instrument through which the few who produce nothing were to enjoy everything, and the many who produce everything were to enjoy nothing. In a new country, with cheap lands and virgin soils, it might be many centuries before the awful results now manifested in England could be worked out, but the process was the same. The same causes were in operation, and the same results would surely follow, differing only in degree. Nor had the Union being confined to the northern states, was there any reasonable prospect before the masses of overthrowing the oppression foisted on them by a resort to revolution and physical force? They were the immense majority, it is true, but without leaders, without education or intelligence or prestige of any kind, their doom was sealed, their subjection certain, their slavery inevitable. It would have been the old story over again. The revolt of the people against their oppressors in 1776 to be again subjected to other oppressions in 1796. A change from one master to another, though doubtless, as all the efforts of the race have been in the direction of progress, a certain advance towards a better condition. But fortunately for mankind, and the cause of free institutions, a widely different state of things existed in Virginia and other states in the South. As fully considered, in another place. The Negro element was here stationary, and in numbers so considerable that rules and regulations were necessary in regards to it. It had to be provided for. Its capacities, its wants, its necessities, in short, harmonized with the wants and well-being of the dominant race. The colonial legislatures, as the state legislatures of the present day, were constantly called upon to enact laws and establish regulations for this subordinate social element, as well as for themselves, and therefore habits of thought grew up that gave them widely different notions of government from those of the people in the North. There was no social conflict. All had the same interests, and if one man inherited wealth and another had nothing but his labour to depend upon, they never came into conflict, for the former never sought the aid of the government to benefit himself at the expense of his less fortunate neighbour. In the North, if a citizen inherited $10,000, he invested it in some special corporation, a bank, a manufacturing company, or something else that had its origin in special legislation, and perhaps doubly increased his income, which of course was drawn from the labourer, the producer, the class that creates all the wealth. In Virginia, on the contrary, if a citizen inherited $10,000, he invested it in lands, in the industrial capacities of Negroes, in short, in labour. And though he may never have laboured an hour with his own hands himself, he became of necessity a producer, with the same common, universal, and indivisible interests of all other producers and labourers, and therefore never sought the aid of government. Indeed, the government could not, nor cannot, at this time, legislate for the benefit, the special benefit, of the planter of the South, or the farmer or producer at the North. And from the day it was created to this moment, there has never been an act of Congress or of the federal government that specifically benefited the South. Congress might, it is true, protect cotton or wheat or other of the great staples which the producers of both sections furnish, but it would be a protection quite as useless to the parties interested as it would be harmless in its results to other classes and interests among us. The clear mind of Jefferson grasped these bonds of industrial interest between the southern planter and northern farmer, the slaveholder of the South and the labourer of the North, at a very early period, and declared them natural allies in the great conflict then pending. The planter or slaveholder of the South asked nothing from government but its protection. He had grown up under a condition of things where there was no social conflict of any kind. There were no opposing interests, no class distinctions, nothing to appeal to his selfishness or to blind his judgment. Society was naturally divided, not into the rich and poor, as elsewhere, but into whites and Negroes, and as the latter was owned by the former, there was no contradiction, no motive, or possible inducement to employ the government as an instrument for the special benefit of any body. The old European notion of government, therefore, that clung and still clings to the northern mind, that government should regulate the religion, the commerce, and the industry of the country, was exploded, and the modern and true American idea that it should simply protect all alike and give favour to none became the general idea of the populations of the South, and indeed of the great agricultural populations of the central states, so far as it could then find expression. And when this was the general notion of Virginia and other states at the South as regards their own legitimate government, of course they would not permit the federal and factitious government, resting on delegated and strictly defined limitations of power, to be perverted in its spirit and transformed by its practice into a machine, as in England, to benefit others at their expense. The southern states, therefore, especially Virginia and Kentucky, met in their legislatures, consulted with other states, and in the celebrated Kentucky and Virginia resolutions of 1798, made a declaration of principles and pledged themselves to a policy that will always serve as the true landmarks of our state and federative systems, so long as the Republic, or indeed American freedom itself, lasts to bless the world and illuminate mankind. These resolutions offered a common platform for the agricultural states, for the producing classes of all sections, for the masses, the millions, in short, for all men who believed in the American idea of government and demanded equal rights for all and favours for none. Thus, the middle states, the great agricultural populations of the North, who, unaided and alone, were powerless in the grasp of the Federal Party, led as that party was by the intellect and sustained by the wealth and social prestige of the North, found themselves naturally allied with the agricultural populations of the South, who were led by men quite the equals in general attainments and vastly the superiors in political knowledge of the great Northern leaders. These men, Jefferson, Madison, George Clinton and their associates, had already conquered in the great intellectual contest that had preceded the creation of the government, and though in the great battle now pending, the centralists occupied vantage ground, for their banks, state debts, and consolidated federal powers attracted to their standards all the selfish interests and mercenary influences in the country, the former again carried the day, and in the great civil revolution of 1800, restored the government, as Mr. Jefferson expressed it, to the Republican tack. This restoration of the federal government to its original purposes was surely second only to the Revolution of 1776 in importance, and without it, it is obvious that the fruits of the former must measurably have been lost. As has been seen, the northern masses were at that time wholly unable to contend with the opposing minority which embraced within its ranks the wealth, talent, education, and social influence of the day. And though largely in the majority as regards numbers, it was powerless even as regards physical force, for it was without leaders to direct its energies or to cope successfully with that brilliant array of able and accomplished civilians and soldiers that gathered about the administration and directed the councils of the Federal Party. If the rule of the Federalists, in the course of time, became personally oppressive, if that personal freedom, which in England permits the subject to enjoy locomotion as he pleases and protects his person from violence, were stricken down, then it may be supposed that the northern masses would have resisted and perhaps, in the progress of the future, have overthrown such government. But the government, actually established by the Federalists, by the false construction of the Constitution, and the usurpations in practice, which would have kept the producing classes, the toiling millions, in the same or similar subjection to a